You are listening to The Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio. And this morning I have with me my mom, Sally Culbertson, all the way from Santa Clara, California. She's our guest speaker today. Well, hi, Mom. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I'm anxious to get on with this program.
All right. Well, Mom and I have both really been enjoying reading books by David McCullough. So principally, that's what we'll talk about. But she's also just recently finished a good one about Daniel Boone. So I'll give you a little background on who David McCullough is, if you don't already know. He is an American author, a narrator, a historian, and a lecturer. He was born in 1933. He is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is our country's highest civilian award. And he was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and he got a degree in English literature from Yale University. And we think of him primarily, I do, as a historian, but I think it was that major in English literature that has allowed him to be such an effective writer. So his first book was the Johnstown Flood, written in 1968, but he's written about Harry Truman, John Adams, the Brooklyn Bridge, most recently the Wright brothers. So he's written, you know, he's chosen, and I often wonder how he chooses his topics. That would be kind of fun to know. So he is quite productive, and he started out, however, his career was with the Sports Illustrated magazine, where he was a trainee, and then he worked as an editor for the United States Information Agency in D.C. And after that, he got a position at the American Heritage Magazine, which is a wonderful history magazine. And it was in editing and writing that McCullough, quote, felt that he had reached the point where he could attempt writing that kind of history himself. And I'll end this part of the intro with this quote. To me, history ought to be a source of pleasure. It isn't just part of our civic responsibility. To me, it's an enlargement of the experience of being alive, just the way literature or art or music is. I thought that was lovely.
Yes, where is that from?
Well, that was David McCullough's comment
about
history. And in fact, before we start talking about books, you made a comment because I had said to you, why do you enjoy reading about history? What?
It is what has created me today and our country and our way of life. It's built upon history, the development of thought, really, and action. The development of thought that results in action and how that action influences all of us in our daily life, it seems to me.
Right, and then you talked about it being an ongoing process.
Oh, it's a continuous process. It doesn't diminish. It just grows and grows and grows.
And so there's a continuity. I think that was a word.
And we hope to grow with it positively, not negatively.
Okay.
I think that's a very important point, that we pick up on the positive effect of this
continuity.
Yes. This,
okay. And then what is it that you have enjoyed about David McCullough?
I feel so at one with what he's describing in history. I think part of it is because I've lived through it myself and I can relate to it. I guess there's just quite a bind there between the reader and the creator of the work.
Well, and I was, as we'll talk about you, I remember in particular when you first were reading John Adams, I would call you up and I'd say, so what's going on with John Adams? And it was as though you were there. And I also feel that McCullough gets sort of develops almost a friendship or an involvement, a real deep involvement with his subjects. And go ahead.
And he brings you into that involvement.
Yeah.
You're not, as a reader, separated from that.
Right. You're living it, kind of.
Yes.
And I think as a consequence, using John Adams as an example, is that there were people who've not written as positively about John Adams, the president, as McCullough did. But I felt like McCullough treated him as a human being with all of his warts and good points as well, and developed a friendship with the guy, and so gave a very, I felt, pretty balanced picture of John Adams. But now we're at the part of the show where I'm going to say, so, Mom, what do you have in your book bag? Which one do you want to talk about first? We've got The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. We've got Orville and Wilbur Wright.
Well, let's just go with the first.
Okay, The Greater Journey?
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll go to Paris.
Okay.
So why would I do that? I was a young girl when that became the business of going to Paris was the thing to be done by anybody who had enough money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some relatives that had gone and come and then brought various things that they had purchased in linens, and even a dress for me, which was quite fancy for a little girl. So that whet my interest. And then that was carried on because I had a sister who moved and lived in Paris, and that kept that interest up in me, which made it possible for me to travel there and live in her home and get a feeling for Paris, and that was quite fun. You had
right. Well, this greater journey that McCullough writes about starts in about 1830 and goes, and I think he kind of begins to wrap it up in maybe 1870 or so. And
so I am out of tune with this question.
Well, not quite, because you had your greater journey. And so as a consequence of your greater journey, you can kind of relate to these people who traveled to Paris. And I think what many of them, of course, were male. And they had to have the means, and in some cases they didn't have a lot of means. Some had more than others. But one of the early ones that he talks about is Fenimore Cooper, James Fenimore Cooper, the writer, who decided he would take, I think he had five children and his wife, to Europe for about 5 years. And he was made close friends with some of the other Americans who showed up. But those early journeys, they all had to go under sail, and sometimes not in very nice weather. And it could take 3 weeks, but more often than not, it would take six. And Matt, you didn't travel that way, did you?
Oh, no, I flew.
So what was really remarkable was they braved that journey, because it was not unheard of that some of those boats wouldn't make it. And one of the familiar names as well was Samuel Morse. Well, we think of the Morse code when we think of Samuel Morse, but he went over to paint. He wanted to study classical painting. Well, you've been in the Louvre, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
And what kinds of things did you see in the Louvre?
Magnificent paintings. It's so vast that it's almost too much to
take in,
yes,
don't you think?
Where a small museums that are around, like the Rodin, are much easier to become acquainted
right.
with the painter.
Well, that's, I guess, one of the reasons that they would go and stay for a length of time. And one of them, and I can't remember whether it was Samuel Morris, decided that he would paint a painting reflecting some of the wonderful things that you would see in the Louvre. So his painting was of kind of like an exhibit hall, and in it were, he had to make copies of many of the famous paintings and things that you would see in the Louvre. He brought it back to the United States, and there wasn't as much interest as he thought there would be. But from his time overseas, he did end up developing the telegraph and the Morse code. So that was one of the early ways that people could communicate in the United States as well as across the ocean. But there was also a time period when they were very known for their medical, or the Parisians were known for their incredibly good medicine. And they also, all healthcare was free, which it still is pretty much in France. But they were particularly known for two things he mentioned, McCullough. One was that in the United States, it was very difficult for women to receive treatment because there were so many male doctors, and they were hesitant to, in America, to rely on male doctors. Whereas in Europe, it was very common, and women were, and then doctors didn't have experience working with women and their health needs. And the other thing that made it pretty wonderful for American students to go study there was they actually had ready access to cadavers, which was not really available to them in the U.S. So imagine being a surgeon and never having had the opportunity to open a body up.
To really study.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So let's see, who else? I think, oh, well, of course, people know that Mark Twain went there. Oh, a wonderful, wonderful portrait painter, George Healy, studied in France and ended up making quite a good living for him, both in France and in America. In fact, Louis Philippe, I guess his title would be emperor. Maybe that's not quite it, but in France, had him return to the United States and copy some famous portraits of people like George Washington and Daniel Webster, and because I guess Louis Philippe was making a collection of beautiful portraits of American statesmen. So it was a really fascinating book. And the thing about McCullough is he can take you there, and without using lots of facts and figures, he relies on individuals to help you see the larger picture, I guess you could say. So I enjoyed that, and I think it probably brought lots of neat memories back to you.
I like him as an author.
I do, too. Well, do you want to talk about Truman? You were telling me a really interesting story about Truman, about his biography and when he was, his leadership in the military.
Oh, yes. I have grown very fond of Harry Truman for many reasons, but this little anecdote has always tickled me. When he was a young man and he became an officer in the military, he was given charge of two batteries, and these two batteries of soldiers were known for their very, very bad behavior. In fact, every officer that had ever been assigned to them didn't make it very long at all, a year or not very beyond a year before they gave up. But Harry stood before these two batteries of men, said not one word, but just looked at them. And he looked over everyone in the battery, and then the second battery did the same thing. And then he repeated it, and then he just stood still and looked. Well, the men had no idea what was going on, but it kind of spooked them. So they maintained their composure and walked out without acting out. Mm-hmm. So later on, he was asked, what in the world was he doing? Or he said, I was so scared, I couldn't speak a word. So he said, I just looked. And that was very...
Right. Harry was... He was kind of an interesting guy. He was a farm boy, and he early on, I think based on some of his father's activities, became pretty interested in politics. And when he was hoping to get his own life going, he was called back to the farm. He was needed there, and so he made that sacrifice to go back to the farm. And then I often think of what it must have been like for someone like Harry, who was pretty, you know, kind of a common guy in some ways, to be in a situation where, you know, one minute he's vice president and not included very much in the administration, and then the next minute he's
president.
And to have to make some decisions related to the use of the atomic bomb when not fully apprised and of... But, you know, based on information that was given to him, had to make that call. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was that after he received an honorary degree, and this was fast on the heels, I think, of him having to return and get to Washington after Franklin died, he said... The next day after receiving an honorary degree from the University of Kansas City, he described how on the flight from San Francisco after a stop at Salt Lake City, he had looked down on the Great Plains and thought of his grandfather, Solomon Young. From Kansas City to Salt Lake City and home again had taken Solomon Young 3 months each way. Now his grandson had done it in 3.5 hours. Quote, I am anxious to bring home to you that the world is no longer county size, no longer state size, no longer nation size. He said, it is a world in which we must all get along. And I think that was the world that Harry Truman, you know, had to, he grew up very differently.
But he had the vision.
Right.
And he had this vision of, my goodness, and how true it has been. We are a global society.
Right. So even at that time, he was sensing that.
Yes.
So that was a good one. I enjoyed Harry Truman. And I know there was a little question about his association with the Prendergast family.
Well, but that John Prendergast was his friend. Now, whether he was a friend from college or a friend from the military... I'm not sure whether Harry ever had any college training, but anyhow, they were young men, and they were friends because of associations taking them into the same theater. And, of course, then became this questionable thing of Harry being attached to the Prendergast machine of Kansas City, which it was the son, and of course the son had a father, and they're just human,
right?
Attachments, and
it didn't appear that he was bought off by them.
No, well, not at all.
Let's take a look at this other thing in your book bag. This is David McCullough, the Wright brothers.
A wonderful. Wonderful story, isn't it?
It is.
And they were mechanics and had thoughts and dreams, and they had this bicycle shop, which gave them an opportunity to work on some of their experiments in flying, which they actually did study the birds very thoroughly. But their original airplanes, it amazes me that the persistence with which they continued to develop the idea. They didn't go very high. They didn't go very far. And before they crashed.
Well, they didn't crash too hard. They pretty much landed.
Yes, they did. Why do I say crashed?
And well, both Wilbur and Orville did experience.
But they did. They landed very quickly. And we should be able to give you the measurements because...
We'll tell people to read the book and then they can get those early flights. But they seem to be such squared away, hardworking guys. Their dad was an itinerant preacher, but he encouraged their experimenting. And what I found fascinating was they'd made real advances, and they were able to, one of the mechanics in the bicycle store was kind of a genius and came up with an engine that they could use.
Lightweight.
But very lightweight. And they took their invention to the military, the United States military, and they just could see no potential use for that ability to have an airplane. So they traveled to Europe, Wilbur did first, and to great acclaim. The French, of course, had been busy working in aviation themselves, but it was Wilbur who was able to fly the plane to make a U-turn, to come back, to make figure eights, and was quite impressive. He did have an accident, though, and then they had to kind of reassemble the plane. And Orville, finally, when the United States government expressed interest, he went up, and I can't think of the name of the fort, but he did have a pretty bad crash and sustained injuries. It took him quite a while to get to recover from it, but I remember a quote from that book that someone asked him, well, how, because they actually did make some decent money in the end from all of the work that they put into it. So how do you become, you know, how did you do this? You were running a bicycle shop. And he said, well, in life, you start out with a good set of parents. I thought, you know, they were just really down to earth guys, but ended up, you know, flying through the air. So that, I thought,
wasn't that beautiful?
Yes, it was. Well, we won't spend a lot of time because I want to know about Daniel Boone, and we're running fast out of town. But The Path Between the Seas.
And you've experienced this.
Well, no, this is, you haven't read this one. I have. The Path Between the Seas is the creation of the Panama Canal. And you've been through the Panama Canal.
Yes, I have.
And what did you think of that?
Well, I was quite surprised because it was just a long journey through water. You didn't really realize what was happening from one side to the other until you were in this huge lake, which you had been lifted by a number of
locks,
but also smoothly. And I expected something much more glamorous than it was. It was an engineering feat.
It was.
And it did take many lives.
It did. And the French were the ones who started it first. They had built the Suez Canal, and so and they had a particularly charismatic man steering the project. Of course, many people invested a lot of money on it, but I think that they don't really know for sure, but they think that they lost somewhere between 20 to 22,000 lives succumbed to the yellow fever. And but
were they mostly Chinese?
Well, they had African Americans. They had laborers from all over the world. And this very charismatic individual, and I can't think of his name, who led this effort, was absolutely dedicated to the fact that they were going to dig a canal that did not use locks. In other words, they would create essentially a river through Panama. And the Americans and many others had actually felt that Nicaragua was a better place to build the canal, but this Frenchman was just dedicated to this idea. And had he listened to other engineers, he might have, and changed his mind, he could have saved people a lot of money and maybe completed it successfully, as it was done later by the Americans. So it's a fascinating read because I think we all have heard of the Panama Canal, but don't really have an idea of how that engineering feat came to pass in the early 1900s, in fact. So we only have about 3 minutes or so. Can you tell us a little bit about this this book about Daniel Boone, by not by David McCullough, but by Robert Morgan?
I loved every moment of it. Daniel was not a very big man, but a very kind man and a very man of great integrity. And what can I say?
We always think of him as a mountain man.
Yes, he was. He was. He loved nothing better than to go in to the forests and mountains alone. He was a loner. He liked being alone. He liked being alone with his own thoughts. And yet he did enter into public life, into politics, and into various things.
Did he encounter Native Americans very much?
Yes. He got along with the Indians, and he was almost he became so much a part of the Issaquas? Sarah.
No, it'll come.
It makes me very angry, but he became so associated with this Indian tribe.
Was it the Iroquois?
Iroquois. Okay. Iroquois. And that he became almost educated by them and did a lot of thinking the way the Indians, the Iroquois, did with the development of the westward movement. At one point, he did something that they felt betrayed them. I think he may have taken a political position against something the Iroquois were doing, but they lost faith in him at that point.
Well, and how did his life end? Did he got married and had children. Did he lose his family?
No, he became very, very close to his family, and wherever he went, he took Rebecca, and not only his family, his brother's family, everybody followed him wherever he went in the family and the
sort of neighbors or
no, the remote relatives, cousins and things of that variety. So he was a trusted individual, but boy, he was honest, and he left debts wherever he was. But at one point in his life, when he began to prosper, he went back to individually to all these people that he owed money to and cleared those debts.
Well, that's a great story, and I would like to listen to it myself. We've run out of time, so I'll just mention that we have talked about David McCullough and his book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, The Wright Brothers, his biography of Harry Truman, and then The Path Between the Seas. It was the story of building the Panama Canal, and a biography of Daniel Boone by Robert Morgan. Thanks very much for listening to The Library Show, and we hope you tune in again next week.
We hope you read.
We hope you read.